rather than saying, in order for me to feel validated, I have to appear this way, we should be thinking about what do I need to give myself to feel comfortable where I'm at right now.
Welcome back, everybody. Hello, hello to all of our listeners. This is Daniela Galdi. I am the producer and co-host of Heal Your Roots podcast. And I am so happy today because we have our newest member of Heal Your Roots Wellness here to talk with us. But first, we have Kira, the co-host, who is also here with us. Kira, go ahead and give him a little hello.
Hey, everyone. I'm Kira Yakubov, co-host and therapist and founder of Heal Your Roots Wellness. Every episode, we talk to a practitioner in the field, get to know who they are as a person and some of their specialties. And I'm really excited for today because we get to have Elijah Jackson. He's part of Heal Your Roots Wellness. And I'm just excited to hear his stories today. And so thank you so much, Elijah, for being on today.
Absolutely.
So we had some technical difficulties, but we're rolling through it. Elijah's been a trooper. So I'm really happy to hear. So it's kind of the first thing I ask everybody is, Elijah, how did you get into like the mental health field? And when did you know you wanted to be a therapist?
Yeah, so there's a silly answer, and then there's a more serious answer. Which one do you want first?
I'm always going to go with silly first, and then you could totally share the serious one, or whichever order you want.
Absolutely. So when I was a kid, my favorite show in the world was, I'm sure all of you are familiar with it, Charmed. It's about the three witches.
Of course.
And Phoebe, the youngest witch, had an advice column, and she had a degree in psychology. And I was like, I thought that was like the coolest job in the world. I was like, I want an advice column. I should go to school to be a therapist, and maybe I can have an advice column. And then after doing research, I was like, wait, Phoebe should be giving people advice. That shouldn't happen. I'm going to go to school and I'm going to do it the right way.
That is the best response, by the way. That is top everything. All of the answers we've heard for this question.
So if I have one person to thank for my career, it's Phoebe Halliwell.
Shout out.
I think that was Alyssa Milano, right? Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. That was, yeah. Mm-hmm. She was always so dressing so like I loved how she dressed too. I was like, I want to wear that.
She was the coolest one.
Oh yeah,
that's hilarious.
But yeah, the more serious, you know, the more serious kind of like grim version is that I just always wanted to learn a bit more about myself. You know, I think lots of us go into the mental health field to figure out our stuff, you know, to figure out our traumas, to understand our bodies and brains a little better, and to help understand the people that are in our lives. So it's kind of both, you know. I wanted to figure myself out as well as figure out some of the people that I grew up with, navigated that way.
Oh, wow. I like the sincere response, too.
I think it's funny and not funny that a lot of therapists, like, it would probably be cheaper if we just went and got therapy instead of becoming therapists.
Mm-hmm.
It's part of the same reason I went into it. Like, I had a tough time growing up and I didn't understand myself, and I would just learn more about psychology and human behavior to understand like why I am the way I am. And I was like, oh, I can help other people do this too. So I love that was a similar path for you as well.
Absolutely. It was the world's most expensive therapy experience.
What was one thing that you learned about yourself from going through all of your schooling?
Yeah, I would say what I learned about myself was that I am extremely hard. I find it extremely difficult to be vulnerable with people. And therapy requires a lot of vulnerability on the therapist's part as well. You know, mm-hmm. It's not all about the client being able to access certain emotions and feelings. You know, I have to do that as well. And, you know, showing up in therapy you're in the room too. You know, your feelings are coming up as well. And you have to confront that and process that in the moment, not make it about you. Like, therapy isn't for me, you know. I have to go see my own therapist for that. But, you know, remembering that I'm also in the room is really important during the therapy process with the client. That, you know, the beginnings of my therapy career, I found it very hard to access certain emotions in the room because I was so used to, you know, not being vulnerable in that way.
I really appreciate that. That was so vulnerable.
I've done a lot of work.
Look at you. Check you out. That's awesome. And so, Elijah, I know you are a licensed social worker. And so my license is a little bit different. So I didn't necessarily know the path that social workers had to take or kind of like the classes and things you learn. So what was your experience becoming a social worker and why did you kind of pick that direction instead of any other type of license?
Yeah, it was a journey for me. I was actually just talking about this with another client because they're pursuing a degree and they are very frustrated with, you know, having to, you know, be set back and switching majors and, you know, having that take longer. So my experience was also very similar. I went to school. I was originally a psychology major, and I wanted to get my degree in psychology. I wanted to get a PhD of all things. And I, you know, I was going through it. I did a year at a really expensive school, and then I ended up, you know, not being able to afford it anymore. So I went home and went to community college. And then I was working somewhere. I think I was working at like a DSW or something. And one of my coworkers had a master's in psychology, and she was like, "Please don't do it. you can do the same amount of work. You can work with the same people with a degree in social work, and you'll be able to have a much more well-rounded career because you can work anywhere." And that's not to knock the psychology people. You can also do a lot of things with a psychology degree. But I just felt like social work fit more for me because it allowed me to access a lot of different communities that I might not have been able to access with a more specific degree.
Actually, speaking to that, can you share a little bit about the communities that you've worked with? Because I know that you mentioned in your bio about like working with the homeless community. So tell us more about that.
Absolutely. So I've kind of been all over the place. I am both, you know, as far as location and career stuff. I'm originally from Long Island. So my first experience doing this kind of work was with the homeless population on Long Island and being able to kind of do more hands-on stuff, you know, still looping in the therapeutic work, all those interventions, but actually having boots on the ground and being able to, you know, have access to communities that, you know, people wouldn't normally have access to. Being able to see the real side of it rather than just what people see walking past, you know, a homeless person on the street. Mm-hmm. I also had experience working with the New York City Child Welfare System, which was traumatic. I did a lot of work with foster kids, mostly teenagers and people who were aging out of foster care. So there weren't a lot of resources for them. Most of them were just thinking about trying to graduate high school, let alone their future, without certain supports like family, and lots of trauma, just in general, like collective trauma. I worked for a college prep program that focused on getting foster kids into college because statistically, it wasn't something that happened that often. And it was pretty difficult. It was pretty hard. So I never want to do that again. But it was a very formative experience. I did really love being able to, you know, help kids access certain things that they might not have, you know, an opportunity to do. Mm-hmm. And then I ended up in Philadelphia. because New York City got too expensive. And I started working with the substance abuse population in Philadelphia. And that was also very heavy. The fentanyl epidemic and, you know, substance abuse is very, very rampant in Philadelphia and all across the country. So being able to also see these people in the throes of their addiction and allowing myself to be more vulnerable with people and recognize similarities and saying, you know, a person who's in the throes of addiction isn't that different from an average person. They still have the same problems. They're still navigating the same stuff. They just also have a layer of trauma surrounding substance abuse. So it really did open my eyes to lots of uncomfortable things, but also things that need to be seen and addressed. And it changed my views a lot about, you know, how substance abuse should be, the epidemic should be addressed. And now I'm here. I heal your reasons.
Wow, that's definitely really deep work. And it's pretty crazy thinking about, like, you know, Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Like, you can't even address other stuff on the surface if you don't have your basics. Like, if you don't have shelter, if you don't have a home, if you don't have food, you don't feel safe in your environment. It's like, you can't even talk about, like, how my relationship feels or how I'm communicating. Yeah. It's like, no, I got to think about day to day. So that's really heavy. I mean, I commend you for going into that, because I didn't have the experience through my training to work with people that were in those circumstances and situations.
Mm-hmm. It was absolutely eye-opening, and I really did love the communities that I've been able to navigate. And it really helped me clarify my niche around who I wanted to work with, what I wanted to do, what I thought I was capable of, and also being able to push myself to be able to say, I didn't think I was capable of this, but I actually am.
Wow, so that sounds like another something that you learned from your work with that. Was it something that you were positioned in, or was you were drawn to it? Like, how did you get started doing that?
Each of those experiences I kind of fell into, I continually told myself that whatever comes my way, I'm going to hop on it and see how I like it. just to continue to clarify what I want to do, you know, how I want to, the kind of therapist I want to be, the kind of social worker I want to be. So it really was important to me to make sure that I continued to try new things.
And so I know that you mentioned it kind of allowed you to get more into your niche and, like, figure out who you want to work with, the kind of things you want to work with. And so what have you come to now thinking about that? Like, who would be your ideal client or who you enjoy working with?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I've, over my very short career, I've learned a lot about my own identities and how I've been impacted by the people that I work with. And I really do think that it's important that I continue to work with people that look like me, and other people of color, people with lots of different intersectioning identities, people who, you know, I love working with the LGBTQ community. I love working with BIPOC, you know, Black, Indigenous people of color. I love working with people whose identities are considered minority, you know, in whatever case that might be, you know, ethnically, religiously, whatever the case is. If you're not considered the norm, as they say, then you'd have a home with me.
Oh,
I love that. You have a home with me. I wish we could, like, hug. That's so beautiful. It really is. I love your sincerity with everything, Elijah. I think that, you know, from a third party, I try to give this perspective since I work trying to do my advocacy with mental health. But I learn a lot from, like, yourselves and Kira and all the therapists and coaches and people that I work with in this advocacy. And just seeing your sincerity is just such a draw to me from that third, you know, that outside perspective of someone who's not a licensed therapist or social worker. It's just, like, so comforting. So I appreciate that so much. But the work that you want and aim to do and that you are doing now is just so impactful. And I want to know a little bit more of a breakdown or maybe your own perspective, because you shared with us in the form that we send to just get to know everybody a little bit more, intersectionality of identities. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to me, I was like, wow, like that's a powerful statement category right there. Mm-hmm. Can you share your perspective on that?
Absolutely. With the intersectioning of identities, I think lots of people view it differently. And my understanding of the intersectioning of identities or intersectionality of identities is just that we're multifaceted beings. We're not defined by one aspect of our lives, you know? We're all impacted by everything that we go through, you know? Someone who is Black, gay, poor, differently abled, those are all different identities that impact them every second of every day. So it wouldn't make sense to say that I am all just one thing, you know, or they are all just one thing. You are defined by all the stuff that you go through. Your positionality is, you know, comprised of everything, all the good and bad, you know, all the stuff that you can't control and you can. All of that stuff impacts how you show up in the room. And I think it's important for me as a therapist to help clients understand that they're more than just one thing. You know, you're not just a queer person. You're not just Muslim. You're not just, you know, your racial and ethnic identity. There's more to you than that. And yes, some things are easier to hide than others, but you shouldn't have to think about hiding it in the simplest form, you know? We should be able to say, I'm all of these things, and that's okay.
I love that so much. And this is when I interviewed you, I was like, oh, Elijah's just so warm and welcoming. Like, you just provide this sense of safety and opening that I really loved when we even just had the interview. And like, even you expressing that, everything you say is just so genuine. And like, we don't look the same on the outside, but I would love if you were my therapist.
Right? Like, thank you so much.
Yeah. And like, you know, therapy seekers, I think the biggest thing that someone wants to know when they're going into therapy is like, can you help me? Can you relate to who I am and what I've gone through? Really, like the credentials, all that stuff, yes, it matters to a degree. But at the end of the day, it's like, we're two people in a room or in a virtual room. Like, yeah. I need to connect and I need to know that you're going to be able to help me because I'm not just this one sliver of an identity. It's all these Absolutely. Different parts. Yeah.
Absolutely. I think sometimes we, as I even know I've had this experience where I've looked for a therapist and I said, okay, well, this therapist hasn't gone through the same thing that I went through, so they won't know how to help me. Mm-hmm. And that's not true. I think that just because I don't have the same experience as someone doesn't mean that they can't offer insight or still help me navigate my own stuff. You know, we're all too unique to assume that someone is going to have the same experience as us, or to cast out someone because they don't.
Mm-hmm. The acceptance piece is so prevalent. And I keep thinking, you know, in the other episode, I pegged Maureen as the sexpert, and I almost want to peg, like, I almost want to title you as, like, Elijah the Embracer. Like, I feel like, you know, like, you're embracing everybody's differences and similarities and making everybody feel united. So I love that. So Elijah the Embracer, my question to you with that is, do you have a certain tool or approach that is like one of your go-tos with anybody that connects with you?
I think, kind of like what Kira said earlier about acceptance, I think is really important to me. Accepting people for who they are is like my most powerful tool, my most useful tool, the one that I, you know, the one that I pull from often. Being able to sit with a person and say, you don't have to explain this to me. You don't have to argue this to me, you know. You don't have to try to convince me that, you know, this is how you need to be. This is why you need to be this way. I am accepting you for who you are. We don't have to go, we don't have to have this discussion. Which is something really important I found that is a tool that I use called queer theory, you know. Many people might know about it. It's the idea of not pathologizing someone's identity, you know, not using them as a, not using tools or theories to try to, you know, turn a client into an experiment or a study tool. This is a person. Their identity is their identity. I shouldn't be trying to, you know, examine them. This is just who they are. You know, if they tell me that this is how they see the world, then I have to respect that. And I can't say, oh, well, because of this book right here, you know, we can't, we have, I have to convince you that your identity is wrong. No. If you believe that you are this way, then as a therapist, I have a duty to respect and accept and validate that. And I think it's important that lots of other therapists adopt that too. We shouldn't be pathologizing our clients.
Absolutely. That gave me the chills. I mean, I, you know, we take an insurance that we accept, and sometimes it really upsets me and makes me angry. And it's really frustrating for the therapist mm-hmm. because we don't always want to give someone a diagnosis, right? Like if it's like a serious disorder or it's a psychotic disorder, like things that are physiologically going on that it would actually be beneficial to have a diagnosis is one thing. But the other thing is, if you're just a person existing in the world and it's hard because it is, and you're responding to trauma that's happening around you and your body is adapting new ways to survive, I don't think that we should be diagnosing people for that, right? Like you learned how to figure out how to survive in this environment because you had to. Now you're in a new environment and it's not helpful, but that doesn't mean there's something wrong with you. That means we're shifting into where we live and who we need to be.
That's one of the things that I've always told. Like when I was younger, I used to tell myself, I don't need a therapist because I don't see people. I don't hear voices, you know. I don't need to be in therapy because, you know, I don't have, you know, dissociative identity disorder or any of the severe disorders. And I questioned myself a lot growing up, and I was like, well, maybe I should be in therapy. And then after learning more about actually what therapy does, I'm like, yeah, I should have been in therapy. It doesn't just require a severe disorder to be able to see someone and navigate your life and work through some of the things that have stuck with you for a long time.
The word doubt keeps coming to mind. Because for right now, you know, I'm experiencing that a lot. Mm-hmm. What's interesting is like, I think that it's in me because of those I've surrounded myself with. And so I think about that and, you know, if I voiced it outwardly, I've gone through anxiety and depression and I managed that, but I've kind of broken it down recently as like, wait a second, I feel good about myself. It's as soon as I have those other, you know, that other noise coming in from others that kind of beats me down a bit. And so thinking of that is just an example for anyone listening of like, you know, I can't diagnose, right? But I wouldn't say that anxiety. I would say that's just, you know, a feeling based on the environment that I'm in, like Kira mentioned about the environment. So like, that's one thing that I'm like, if I did not talk to somebody about this, they could just spiral.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think if you are someone who experiences how horrible life can be, then you have a right to be in therapy. You don't have to be a traumatized, broken down person to go to therapy. You can just be someone who needs support.
Absolutely. And so it's interesting with all these different identities, right? Like it's our subjective experience for the most part, right? Like there's an external expression of who we are that people can kind of see and label or put us in a box. And I think that especially with gender, it's very much a subjective experience. And so I'm curious of how that shows up in whether it's your sessions or maybe some of the experience you've had with people who have like this discrepancy between the subjective experience they're having and maybe how people view them on the external expression.
Absolutely. So many of my clients who are questioning their gender feel like because they're not at one end of the extreme where it's like, so, you know, I always say gender and sexuality is a spectrum. Everyone falls somewhere on that line. You know, some people are more in the middle, some people are all the way at either end, you know? And when some people are more in the middle or in one of the other gray areas, they feel like they don't have a right to explore that more. They don't have a right to think about how they'd like to clarify. You know, what would it take for them to clarify what their gender is or their sexuality is? Some people feel like, oh, well, it's not something that's really that deep for me. I just feel sometimes I like to wear dresses, or sometimes I feel more comfortable going by he, him rather than she, her. And, you know, the discussion of pronouns and the clothes you wear, how you present your gender, all of that is so fluid. And people think that in order to live life, they have to be perceived one specific way. And rather than saying, in order for me to feel validated, I have to appear this way, we should be thinking about what do I need to give myself to feel comfortable where I'm at right now? You know, maybe down the line you want to go further down that spectrum and maybe get top surgery or explore taking hormones, things like that. But right now, where you are, what feels right? And that's a question that I love to ask my clients is, what do you need right now? Maybe it's not in the cards to get top surgery or bottom surgery for that matter, or, you know, but how can we get you where you'd be safe? You know, what does safety look like right now?
I absolutely love that question. I want to adapt that for myself every day. Like, what do I need right now? I think that's such a great way to bring us. I mean, clearly it brings us back to the moment, but brings us back to knowing who we are as well. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think I love that. I love that you start with that. I feel like it just simplifies these complexities that I'm sure the people you are talking with are you know, minds are might be racing with. Do you have any thoughts around the idea of like mindfulness to share with anyone listening?
Absolutely. Being present is so powerful. That's one of the things that I've struggled with the most in my life, even just, you know, not even in my therapy work, just in my day-to-day life. Being present, being mindful, it's extremely hard. Mm-hmm. We are always, I think as humans, we're trained to be forward thinking. We're trained by our society, whether it be capitalism or our jobs, well, that's capitalism, but all aspects of our lives are pretty much trained for us to be forward thinking. From the day that you graduate high school, even before that, they ask you, what do you want to do for the rest of your life? What's at 18 years old, we're expected to decide what we want to do until we retire at 65, you know? It's extremely traumatizing. It's so scary. So we're trained to be thinking in the future. We're trained to be anxious. And it's important that, as for me as a therapist, it's important to help clients slow down, to pull you back into reality or back into the real world. We don't always have to exist in the future. Yes, we do have to plan for some things, you know, we do have to plan for our futures in some capacity, but we can't do it all. We're not that powerful. I think one of the things that I've learned as a therapist and as just an individual is that I don't have that much power. You know, I can't control that many things. I can do my best. I can try to show up as best as I can, but for the most part, I'm just coasting along on this rock floating through space. You know?
That's right.
Oh, yes. Aren't we all? But no, it's okay.
I want to go back to something you said a little bit earlier that came up for me is the way you were describing accepting people. And towards the end, it was, what would be the safest for you right now? Mm-hmm. And I think that is so important to consider, especially when we're talking about minorities and cultures, because I think in America, we're a very individualistic society. And a lot of minorities, and I'm an immigrant, is much more collective. Mm-hmm. And when we think about how we move in the world and the decisions we make, it's we are trained to think about how is this going to impact my family, my community, who I live with, how people view me and people who look or identify like me.
Absolutely.
And that feeling of safety in making a decision when you live in a community right. like that. And I'm right. curious, so what's been your experience with some clients when maybe they are starting to embrace who they are, but their community or their family is not Absolutely. Okay with it?
Absolutely. I think, and that kind of goes back to what I was saying before about intersectioning identities. Sometimes our intersectioning identities kind of go against each other. My, you know, a client's sexuality might butt heads with their religion. You know, a client's gender identity might butt heads with the culture, you know? So a client who is trying to explore their gender identity, they don't feel right in their body. They want to explore wearing other gendered clothing, even though clothing isn't gendered. It's just clothes. It's just fabric. Mm-hmm. But as a society, we've assigned meaning to a dress. We've assigned meaning to a suit. So I think that clients who want to explore that feel that, wow, I don't feel safe wearing nail polish at home. I don't feel safe wearing the skirt around my parents. I could be cast out or worse for doing these in my community, doing these things in my community. So when it comes to exploring our identities, we have to think about safety first, you know? What's going to ensure that you are going to be safe until you can get to a point where you can go out on your own and explore your identities, you know? I have so many clients who live in toxic households and can't explore their identities, and they feel stuck. And it takes a lot for them to really pull themselves back into reality and say, yes, I can't do this right now because it's scary, but I'm working towards a point where I can get away and still explore who I truly am. And sometimes that feels like, you know, it's not enough, but safety matters above all else. We don't deserve to suffer over things that we can't control.
Mm. That was really powerful.
Yeah, that was amazing. That's what I was just thinking, like, the way that you break that down so that they always have a place of safety within themselves, even if it's not in their surroundings. What's a way that they can explore? Like, what's a safe mm-hmm. way that you mm-hmm. suggest to explore, but still Absolutely. Withholding that safety within where they are, like, living, Absolutely. So to say?
Part of what makes the internet so powerful, I mean, the internet sucks in a lot of ways. There's so much that's horrible about it. But I will say that lots of clients who cannot access certain communities in their general area find those communities online, you know? They're able to find through apps like Twitter and Instagram, you know, all those places are toxic, et cetera, et cetera. But you can still find communities of people who identify the same way you do. You can find someone who you can talk to when your parents scare you. You can find someone to communicate with when you feel like you're being silenced. You know, I think that community is very important. And if we can't get it in our general vicinity, if we can't get it in our hometown, we have to find it elsewhere. Because in order for us to you know, to be validated, we need a community that looks like us. Our experience is what we experience.
That's so important. I think it always kind of comes down, it's tough because there's always two sides of the same coin, right? It's we thrive in community and we feel connection and I mean, we're social beings, right? Like we're built to last with other people. And then at the same time, if there is a norm around what we're supposed to look like, feel like, act like, and we don't, A, shame comes up internally. And then two, we can get ostracized from that community that we so desperately need to be a part of to feel like we belong.
Absolutely.
So I just can't imagine the amount of suffering that someone might go through feeling like they have to like walk the line between those things. And I'm so glad that there are therapists like you, Elijah, that welcome that. And it's like, here's a space to explore that and be mindful of what I can do right now and just hold that space for somebody.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Part of, you know, I think some people have these ideas around therapy where it's like, every time I come to therapy, I have to be talking about stuff that really hurts. I have to be talking about all this, all the trauma and all the sucky stuff. And I'm like, well, yes, you should be exploring your traumas because they need to be explored. But also we can use therapy to talk about, you know, the fact that you just bought a dress and you feel really comfortable, you know? We can talk about the fact that, you know, you had your first kiss from a same-sex person, you know. I think there's so many ways to experience acceptance and validation, and we don't just have to validate the traumatic stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm. Having a space where you can have, like, someone excited about the news you want to share, that's just as important, I think.
Yeah, I was just going to touch on that because the celebration part is what you both mentioned. And that to me means so much, you know, to have that person by your side who's like, yes, that's great. And that's regardless if they understand it or not, but they're happy to see you happy and doing what you want and what has meaning to you and living the life that has meaning to you and, you know, taking action in that way. So having that celebration, and I can attest to going into therapy, I usually recommend to people, you know, they're like, I'm feeling great. I don't know. Do I have to go to the session? And I'm like, I always encourage you to keep your sessions because you never know what could come up. But like, just tell somebody something that you know has your back, you know, just go talk to somebody that you can feel safe with. That's like the key word here, right? Safe and supported with. And so, you know, I always feel like, and in my own personal experience, I've done that. And then I've shared great things. And then all of a sudden I was like, it's one of the best sessions because something else came up. I think, you know, because I had let go and I had let all of those great things come out that it was like, okay, there might've been something else that I never allowed to surface that then needed some extra support, you know?
Absolutely. So, and that's why I think mindfulness is so important, you know, and mindfulness can be anything. Being mindful of what comes up in the moment, being able to process that as it comes by, and being able to say, you know, I'm going to stay present where I am. I'm not going to let these intrusive thoughts or these negative thoughts pull me a certain way. I'm going to sit where I'm at and continue to explore this thing that I'm really excited about. You know, I'm going to continue to sit with what I'm feeling right now rather than being pulled aside by my anxiety or by the things that hurt. And, you know, mindfulness practice can be anything. I've just discovered that you can mindfully eat.
I discovered that too, and it's not fun.
It's so funny. I've been doing like, well, I've been trying to practice it consistently, like mindful, conscious eating. And to your point, yeah, sometimes it's not fun, but definitely, you know, real quick, a quick digression here is like, that shame piece that you mentioned earlier, eating is, I'm Italian, I'm first generation. And so it's such a big practice. Unfortunately, my parents are understanding about if I'm trying to eat a certain way. Right. And then I find the difficulty because I feel the guilt and a bit of the shame that I don't want to always go with the traditions because of the way I want to choose to eat. Right. And that's always on me, but that's something with the mindfulness where it's like, once I can accept that for myself, that this is how I'm choosing and it's my choice, you know, it becomes a bit easier to recite that, right? And like claim it and assert that to somebody else and in a graceful way. So to add that in terms of like mindful eating, but just in terms of mindfulness in general, when it comes to different cultural things.
Absolutely. Mindful eating does suck. I tried it once.
I tried it once.
And it was like, but I get the idea behind it. It's like you're supposed mm-hmm. to be more conscious of what you're putting into your body.
Yeah.
And, you know, lots of times people are just, they're eating, they're not thinking about it. And then they're not realizing that, oh, I'm full. And I'm still eating because I still have food on my plate, you know? knowing when you're being present in what you're doing rather than doing things on autopilot. We do that a lot. We're mm-hmm. always on autopilot because it makes the time go by faster. But sometimes sure. we need to slow down a little bit.
So I feel like there could be a whole episode on culture and eating mm-hmm. because and I remember learning about this a long time ago, like the way that it even came up that people eat together, like that is like a gathering, is like when cavemen or humans discovered fire and they would all sit around the fire to be warm and to eat. And, you know, you spend time talking, singing, whatever, right? You're bonding over eating. Mm. And I think at least definitely in my culture, it's so interesting because there's like this very mixed message. Between you need to eat, why aren't you eating, you look too thin, like you're not healthy, like you should eat more, finish everything off your plate, people are starving in the world. And then it's like looks like you're gaining weight, who's gonna marry you? I'm like, damn, so which is it?
honestly mm-hmm. so many talks, you know, there's so many toxic messages that, you know, are perpetuated through culture and through history and through families. And sometimes you get treated like an outcast when you start to think about, wait, these are the things that we say to each other all the time?
Mm-hmm.
This is okay to say to your son or your daughter or your aunt or your uncle, you know? Why are we focused so much about what this person's body looks like, you know, or how much they're eating? How is that going to impact them getting married, et cetera? And I think that's why I think our younger generation is so powerful, because, you know, Gen Z, as kooky as they are, they're questioning everything. they're questioning yes. a lot of things. You know, they're starting to do some of the things that we felt a little bit uncomfortable with.
And I think it's so interesting. It's like, because I see things from such a cultural perspective because I have how I grew up. And it's even questioning why things are the way they are. It could be frowned upon and seen as disrespectful and like mm-hmm. disobedient or, you know, like subordinate. Like, how dare you ask about this thing?
Right.
And really, it's like, you probably don't want to take accountability for the thing because now you just realize it's kind of shitty that we've all been doing this for so long. And B, it's like, well, now it means if I accept that it was wrong, it means I have to change and I have to put in an effort to do something differently. And I have to listen to understand your experience. And that's too much
Absolutely.
Work.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Accountability is hard for older generations. Mm-hmm. They don't want to accept that they've had an impact on, you know, how we show up today.
Do you either of you have a tip to share in terms of like being better about accountability? Because I kid you not, I was just looking up for myself the other day two things. One was how to understand accountability, and then one was working through entitlement.
For me, I would say that when it comes to accountability, the main thing that comes up the most is expectation. What do we expect of other people? You know, are our expectations too high? Are we expecting things that people aren't capable of doing? And what do we expect of ourselves? You know, how are we showing up in a way that validates ourselves, but also other people? Because we also have to think about the people that we're interacting with as well. And when it comes to accountability, sometimes people expect someone to show up a certain way, you know, or you don't expect anything of yourself and others, and you're wondering why people are like, no, I need you to respect me, you know, I need you to understand that this is how I am and this is how I show up. And then we're questioning, like, oh, so there is an expectation around how I show up in the room. And I have a duty to either, you know, respect that, you know, and validate that, but also question it if it's too much. If someone is expecting something of you that is too much for you in the moment or doesn't align with how you want to show up, how you want to be present, then you have a right to question it.
I love that. I think for me, what comes up is giving and receiving feedback, because that is a skill on its own that I was never taught. And so I think even just through the therapy process and working with couples, it's if you want things to be a particular, if you have those expectations, if you want a certain type of life or quality of life, it's considering, like, can I share this with someone? And am I open to hearing what they have to say about me? If I want my relationship to improve, if I want my life to improve, my problems to dissipate in some way, am I open to hearing how I'm getting in my own way? Because if you're not open to hearing how you're getting in your own way, or you're impacting somebody else, you're going to make them the bad guy, and you're not going to change or put in any effort. And then you're kind of in that victim mentality.
Right.
And so so you have to be, and it sucks, right? Like, it's not fun, right? Like, I'm in a marriage, I have other relationships. Like, it's not fun or pleasant or comfortable to hear how your behavior is negatively impacting somebody that you care about. It's right. not. And if you're not willing to hear how they feel or the impact it has on them, don't expect this relationship to thrive or to move somewhere. And like Elijah said, if you feel like, well, maybe these are unreasonable expectations you have of me, then you can question that and say, this is what I'm willing to provide based on the feedback you gave me. And then they have a decision to continue this or not.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that also goes over, that goes back to, you know, or at least it made me think a lot about readiness. How ready are we to change?
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes there are problems that arise and we don't know they're problems yet. Or there are questions that we have, but we don't feel capable or ready to address those questions. They're just questions that are popping up for us. That's something that I go through a lot with my clients is, how ready are you to address these problems that are popping up in your life? Because it's one thing to just say, yeah, this is a problem for me. But it's another thing to say, I'm ready to do something about it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And some clients aren't ready to do something about it. So it takes more time. We have to slow down a bit. And we have to be more mindful of where we are and more mindful of our readiness to change.
It's another great question to add to a little like self-check-in that we've talked about in this episode already, because it makes me think for myself too, you know, how ready am I? I had a situation happen and somebody said to me, are you going to therapy? And I will tell you both right now, I'm not at the moment. I'm an avid goer, but I've been taking some time off and it made me think, like, question myself. Wait a second, should I be? And I had to kind of pull back and ask and that question, I didn't know it came up in this way, but now that you're saying it, no, I'm not ready to address it yet. I'm not, it would be one of those situations where I would avoid everything. Talk in circles, right? I'm not ready to fully go there. But I will be. And then I know that therapy is there for me when I'm Absolutely. There to confront that situation. Although I do always suggest, like I mentioned earlier, continue to go, but you know, circumstantial situations.
Absolutely.
With that said, Elijah, what's one thing that you're comfortable sharing that your clients may not know about you?
I wasn't going to share it then.
If you're comfortable, whatever you're comfortable sharing.
No, I'm usually pretty transparent in my sessions, but I would say that I'm a big nerd. I do love all things comic books, all things, you know, all things action. I, you know, it's kind of a guilty pleasure of mine. Actually, no, I should take that back. I don't feel guilty about any of my pleasures.
There you go.
But yeah, I do love a good comic book. I love a good comic movie. I can talk about things like the MCU for hours. So yeah, any client who loves comics, you know, we can spend hours talking about that.
So this one's like embarrassing, but I guess I shouldn't be embarrassed because it's fine. So when I was younger, I was like, for the listeners, have you guys seen Bob's Burgers?
Oh, she was awesome.
Okay. You know, Tina. I am Tina. I was Tina. And so when I was younger, like, I don't know, 13, 14 years old, I would write these like romantic encounters of how I would meet somebody and like these erotic stories in my diary. Like a little weirdo. I guess it's not weird for anybody else who does it, but I thought I was a little weirdo and just like fantasize and live in a dream world.
So I love that you're both sharing these. Please keep going.
That's all I got.
That's all you got. Okay.
I didn't write erotic stories, but I did because, as I mentioned, I'm a nerd. I used to create, even though I was a horrible artist growing up, I did not have that kind of hand-eye coordination. I used to create my own comic characters. And I used to have whole stories for them. I used to have books growing up. And my mom would always find books of me with like different characters that I created. And then I always used to tell her, Mom, I'm going to put them all together and I'm going to make a comic book. She's like, okay, I'm waiting. Years and years go by and it never happened. I wish I still had those books because they did bring back a lot of fond memories. So I didn't do any of the erotic stories, but I did create a lot of scenarios.
You were a sexually charged adolescent as I was. Oh my god.
Oh, I feel like I should add to that, but I'm trying to think.
In honor of
you both exposing something. I mean, I'm thinking of like one that's not that cool. I mean, but I guess I shouldn't judge. It's like I had a pet rock named Princess. Now my rock has turned into like a crystal obsession, I guess, as I've become an adult. And I used to, in terms of writing, not comic books, not erotic, but I plagiarized as a child and would write down song lyrics in my songbook, and these were like my songs, and I'm air quoting. And I remember my sister found my book and she was like, you know, these aren't yours. Why are you just writing lyrics to songs? It was like Saved by the Bell, like when they did their whole choir thing, and like, you know, I don't know, some other artists in there. And I was like, this is my songbook. And I think I convinced myself that, like, I wrote these songs.
Oh, my gosh.
I plagiarized the crap out of them. So. Oh, my
God. Look at us all just trying to cope as kids.
We all find a way to escape. Escape is real.
That's right. So as sad as I am to end this episode, Elijah, thank you so much for being on. This was a pleasure. It's getting to know you a little bit more and hearing more about your life and background. So thank you so much for taking the time today to be with us.
This is a Bivesta production.